We're going to talk to Mark Horowitz about the creation of the Bela Fleck Bluegrass Heart Banjo. You're going to learn so much. Get your pencil and a piece of paper ready.
I'm happy to welcome back to Unreal Bluegrass my very good friend, a banjo player extraordinaire, Mark Horowitz. How are you, Mark?
Good evening.
Mark has been a friend of mine for a long time, and he's one of those people that has that rare quality. He can say that he's been a guest on Unreal Bluegrass 5 times.
I'm in the five-timers club.
You're a five-timers club, and what do you get for that?
I get a blazer. Where's my blazer?
No, you get a hat. 5 is a hat. 25 is a blazer. 5 is a hat. So the purpose of this conversation is, first of all, I want Mark to tell the audience, if you didn't catch the other 5, a little bit about his background. But we're going to come and focus on this brand-new Sean Goldtone, the music group Goldtone, this Bela Fleck Bluegrass Heart Banjo. Mark was very involved in creating that, and it's a really, really cool banjo. It's way beyond my ability to describe it. So we're going to get to that. Mark has one with him, and he can demonstrate some of the features of it. But Mark Horowitz, for the listeners out there in Radio Land, you've been doing this banjo stuff for a long time.
I started playing in June of 1960, so that makes me 62 years behind the banjo, with no time off for good behavior.
And you're only 64 now.
I wish.
So you were part of that whole movement of bluegrass into New York that went from the folk. We'll just do this quickly. It went from the folk. You went right into the bluegrass from that. So explain that a little bit about that history of New York.
We called what happened in New York from about 1958 through about 1975 the folk scare. but it stemmed from quite a long period of time before that, dating back to the early 40s. Where there was a lot of interest in New York City amongst intellectuals. A lot of the Jewish population was very interested in rural American music, and a lot of guys from New York City got involved in it, including, you know, who we consider to be the pioneer of three-finger banjo in New York City, Roger Sprung, who was a friend of mine, and I think he's still with us. I think he's well into his 90s now. And Roger was the first guy to play rug-style banjo in the Northeast. He started around 1949. And I knew Roger, and like a lot of people in New York, I bought an instrument or two from him. And, you know, just we would meet in Washington Square Park during the Halcyon period, where all of the bluegrass musicians would come there on Sundays from between 12 and 6. On Sunday afternoons and just play music out in the hot sun and get all dehydrated and pass out.
Those were the days.
But to encapsulate, you know, just how I got to where we are today, I became a professional musician at about 17. I think I played my first recording session. My mentor and once upon a time idol, Eric Weisberg, was very kind in getting me into the recording situation, and I began doing studio work, and that turned into more things like Broadway show pit orchestras, and then I began touring with people, folk artists like Steve Goodman and Judy Collins and a few others, and did that pretty much full time, being a musician, that is, until I was about 38 years old, and I got tired of waiting for the phone to ring, so I went into other things, which is how I ended up being a manufacturer's rep for, among other people, St. Louis Music and Gibson and Music Corp. And then I became associated with Goldtone as an independent rep about 15 years ago. Got to know the family down there, Wayne and Robin, and the girls all very well, and would go to do NAMM shows with them even after I stopped being an independent rep. I kind of ended up as a de facto advisor on things banjo. That evolved into an actual consultancy whereby I'm starting to, I started to design instruments with and for them. So that's how the Bela Fleck Bluegrass Heart Banjo came to be.
I think, Mark, it's fair to say that Wayne, even if it's not an identifiable project like the banjo we're going to talk about, the Bluegrass Heart Banjo, Wayne consults with you, and I think you even write some of the literature describing some of his instruments, maybe a little bit, but he always touches base, I think, with you about things beyond just this banjo. It's a constant kind of back and forth.
Yeah, we're in constant touch. Wayne recognized in me, I think, He asked me to proofread a business letter he was writing, so I rewrote it for him. I sent it back to him, and he liked it a lot. So he began asking me to rewrite copy for the captions on the online catalog for various products. I ended up editing the whole site at one point about 5 years ago, and then from then on, I was writing ad copy and other stuff like that. So yeah, it's become a very nice close association, and he does call me whenever he has a question about vintage banjos and, you know, what features we should put on the next thing and what kind of projects have I been thinking about. And that's it's been a pleasure. It's just, you know, I've been doing a lot of setup work for folks for the past 15, 20 years, and so this is just an extension of that. Wayne loves to come up with ideas for hybrid and different instruments, from solid body electric banjos with 8-inch heads to octave guitars in the shape of an F-style mandola, and all kinds of pickups and banjo basses. It's just fascinating how many. Right now, I think that their product range is at least 150 different instruments. And on top of that, they're all very reasonably priced. You know, Wayne has done everything he can to keep prices down, even with increasing costs all over the world. And he just continues to provide what I think is the biggest bang for the buck on the market.
What I was going to tell the people listening, I'm going to interview Wayne. I'm interviewing you now again. I'm going to talk to Wayne about Gold Tone, but just so everybody knows this, in the past, I've interviewed a lot of manufacturers, a lot of luthiers, including from Deering, from Stelling, from Neckville, from Bourgeois. I like to do this because I like to know how these things are put together and what goes in the mind of the people doing it. So it's not just Wayne of Gold Tone, although I will also, in all openness, tell the audience that I currently have in my possession one of the banjos that we're going to talk about, and I'm kind of experimenting with it, and I enjoy it immensely, and I thought, and you thought it'd be good for you to explain how it got there. Now, first of all, your connection with Bela goes way back. You were one of Bela's first teachers in New York, right?
Yeah, I was the second teacher he came to after Eric Darling, who was the folk banjoist who replaced Pete Seeger in the Weavers.
Wow.
When Pete left. And then I got a call from Eric. We were friends, casual friends, and would run into each other various places in Greenwich Village back in the day. Anyway, he called me up and said, I've been teaching this kid. He's 15, and he's really quick and good. And you know, he wants to learn three-finger and I really don't do a lot of that. So can I send him to you? I said, sure. What's his name? He said, Bela Fleck. And I said, no, really, what's his name? So that was the beginning of that. And I'll never forget that he left that the day he came for his first lesson. He left and went back to the city. I was living in Brooklyn with my new wife at the time. And my wife came in and said, how is he? And I said, you know, he's only been playing a little while, but I think he really gets it.
Yeah, good call.
I really just, you know, because you can tell you have a good student across from you when they listen to what you're saying and what you're playing at them. And they don't play while you're talking, and they don't play while you're speaking to them. I rather when you're playing something for them. And then he takes the time to play something little by little. It was just a very deliberative process on his part. And as time went on over the next year and a half, 2 years, it was just more of the same. And so I really didn't have to teach him anything except, you know, clean up a few fingerings here and there and some repertoire, you know. But it came a point when he said to me that he wanted me to teach him some of the stuff that Tony Trischka was putting out. Because Tony had just put out Bluegrass Light, his first album. And there was a lot of great, weird stuff on there. And I learned some of it, and I had to keep learning it week by week. You know, he'd say, hey, do you know this one? I said, yeah, I'll give you a week, I'll learn it. So I had to learn it before I taught it to him. Finally, I just said, hey, you know, I think it's time you went and studied with Tony. He's just over in New Jersey. So that's how that worked. And from then on, you know, the rest is history.
So that gives, I will tell you this, and as we talk about this banjo, which you have in your hands, it's an amazing instrument to me. It has features different than any other, I'll call a bluegrass style banjo, and I have a couple of those. It has features about it that I knew existed, And I've never tried to play it. And that's why I want you to explain how we get from what people would consider, I guess I would think a bluegrass banjo in most parlance would be not a radius neck, not the strings, not this high, not the string separation. It's more straight. But so this is totally different. So let's talk about how we got to where we are and then tell me about the differences as they develop.
Yeah, I think this is a good point to bring up the OB3 twanger. I became aware of this this banjo that Wayne was putting out at the behest of banjoben.com, a nice online store, and a brick and mortar as well. But the guys there had approached Wayne with the proposition of him having built a banjo to emulate J.D. Crowe's banjo, a flathead that he had for decades. He nicknamed Banger, because people used to say to him, "That's a real banger you got there." So it had a no-hole cone ring and a thicker rim, the early rim, and it was an original five-string. So they did that, and it came out. And then shortly after that, I became aware of this, and I asked Wayne to send me one so I could look at it. I set it up my way, and lo and behold, if it wasn't the best banjo I played, and I couldn't remember how long. And I have some nice banjos in my stable.
Yes, you do.
Now, and I did at the time. So I started to use it with the band I'd been rehearsing with, Andy's Ramble. So after a couple of months, I was sitting at my computer one evening just kind of looking at the catalog online for Gold Tone, and I thought for a second, and I picked up the phone and called Wayne and said, you know, I think that the pot from the OB3 twanger would make a great platform on which to try to maybe emulate Bela's original pre-war flathead with the special neck that he had made for it. I need to elaborate on that, too.
Yeah, go ahead. I want you to.
Because I provided that banjo for him, too. I was working at Mandolin Brothers, and this is back in the early 80s, and Bela had asked me to keep my eyes open for a flathead. And we got a banjo in that was a tenor that had come out from under a bed. And we knew this because of the state that it was in. You know, it was dusty, and it looked as if and proved to be, it had never been apart.
And for the audience, remind them, I'm talking to Mark Horowitz, but when you say tenor, in their mind, you want them to think of it not a five-string neck.
Well, yeah, it was you know, as many of your listeners know, the only difference between a Gibson tenor banjo or any tenor banjo and a five-string is the neck, which bolts on and off like a carburetor on a car. That's what I love about banjos. You can just tinker with them. So this tenor came in, and now as a now, it's a common practice to make a replica five-string neck and put it on a pre-war pot. So I looked this banjo over, and this banjo was guaranteed by me and Stan Jay, he should rest in peace, he was the owner of Mandolin Brothers, and we guaranteed it to be, as it was stated to be, a pre-war flathead intact. But it did have one characteristic which back in those days made a lot of people suspicious, and that's that the master tone decal inside had a cut-off top, which usually meant, or could mean, that the top of the rim, the wood rim, had been milled down or lathed down to accept the new flathead tone ring, which Gibson phased in over the period from 1929 to 1931. And we talked about it, and we came up with an explanation which seemed reasonable, and then when we checked with some other authorities, they agreed. And that explanation was simply that Gibson had to have had finished rims up on the shelf or hanging from hooks. And when they got a work order in, they would pluck one off the wall and use it for the banjo. When the transition to the flathead tone ring came in, they weren't going to junk these banjo rims, which had been finished, that is, stained and finished with lacquer, and the labels applied. They weren't going to not cut them down and use them for flatheads. They didn't foresee a day in which people might be suspicious about the authenticity of a flathead banjo. To them, it was just a change in specification. Long story short, we told Bela that it was our considered opinion that this was an original flathead pot. At the time, it was worth probably about $7,000. And that was top dollar for just a pot.
Just a pot.
Yeah. And we said to Bell, look, we can't 100% guarantee that this is an original flathead and it wasn't converted from an arch top because of that cut decal. So you can have it for $4,000. I think we made $500 on the thing, basically. So Bela bought it. He had the good sense to buy it. And then Bela called me a few days later and said, who do I go to for a neck? I have some very definite ideas about what I want. Do you think John Monteleone, who was to this day the greatest builder of archtop guitars in the world, you think John
beautiful would, guitars, just beautiful.
Yeah, and he knew John. He had met John when he was up in New York because he's from here. And he asked me if I would intercede with John on his behalf and get him to. But John wasn't interested in building any banjos at this point. So I called John and prevailed upon him to do that. So Bela wanted a neck that was both wider and thicker than a standard banjo neck. And he also wanted a radius fretboard, like a guitar, or like the top tension banjos that Gibson put out in the late 30s. So John built him the neck, and that neck is the same exact neck that Bela has on his PB75. I think it was a Plectrum, actually. PB75 hot. Or I'm not sure if it was a PB or a TB, but anyway, it was a flathead 75. And that is the same banjo he's been playing since then. It's his number one. And how the Bela model came about was, I told Wayne, as I said, that I thought this would make a great pot to build a replica on. And Wayne said, well, do you think Bela would want us to do that? And I said, well, I'll call him and ask him. So I did. And I said, look, you've been telling me for years you wanted something to take on the road that wouldn't be as full of risk as taking your flathead in certain situations. Let us see how close we can get. Tell you what, we'll send you an OB3, and you can set it up any way you want and see if you think there's potential there. And the original thought for this was just to build him a road banjo. We had no intention of that at that point of doing a model and making more of them and offering them for sale.
So, and Mark, so the OB3 that you're talking about, that did not have the radius neck, or did it?
That was a standard style 75, yeah.
Okay, and then for the people listening, when I say radius neck or I say radius fretboard, it's the, maybe you can explain it better because they're not seeing what I'm seeing and they don't know maybe what I know.
Yeah. But radius simply means that the fingerboard has a curve to it from side to side. That's an arched fingerboard. And this is supposedly intended to help the fingers of the left hand match the arched attitude that they take over the fingerboard. It helps them match the finger positions better to the fingerboard, resulting in easier playing. And it does, but it's something that people would need to get used to in most cases. The neck was quite a bit wider than a standard neck. And in fact, when Bela took delivery of the banjo, he told me many, many years later, he thought it was really too big, but he didn't really want to go back to John and just thought he would get used to it, which he did. And so I said, let's send you an OB3. We sent him an OB3, called me up a couple of days later and said, I don't know. I don't know if there's anything there. I said, well, keep it for a week or two. Just mess with it in your spare time. Bela doesn't have much spare time, but a week later he called me up and said, you know, Noam Pichelny came to visit me last week because he was living in Nashville at the time too. And I gave it to him to try and he really loved it. Said, this banjo sounds great. So I told him about the project and he said, yeah, I mean, I think you should go ahead and let him build you a neck. So I guess we should start maybe building a neck.
So Noam was commenting on the OB3.
Right. He was talking
about modifications.
Right. Okay. No modifications. He liked the sound of the pot.
Okay.
So then the idea also that, you know, Bela had when he originally envisioned this bigger neck was that the extra mass would give a fatter tone. So at this point, we got measurements from Bela. We did one prototype. Wasn't what he wanted. We then said, look, we need to get better measurements. He says, well, I'm not shipping you my banjo. I said, I understand that. And he had told me once about a prototype that Gibson had tried to get him to sign up with back about 10, 12 years ago. And he ended up keeping that neck. And he said it was really very close to what he wanted. So we got him to send us the neck. We had the next stand into the CNC computer, and the next prototype was very close, and we did one more, and that was it. And so, of course, along these steps of the way, we began talking about doing a model. What else would he want on it, and what would it take for him to put his name on it? And we got all that straightened out over a period of 2 or 3 months, or more like actually 3 or 5 months. A lot of conference calls and emails back and forth, and we finally got it. I'd say from the first idea to the first shipment in was about a year and a half, which is still record time, I think.
Yeah, well, it is, and some of that was over COVID. So, like you're saying, you're doing all this.
Oh, yeah, plenty of time on our hands.
So not only the neck is radius, the frets are fatter. Right?
Yeah, the frets are more like guitar frets. And
the spacing of the strings is wider than most people would play.
Well, funnily enough, it happens to be just like crow spacing.
Okay, all right, good enough.
Yeah, so when we made the second prototype, Bela said the neck could be a little slimmer side to side, a little narrower, as it goes up towards the pot. So in other words, the nut width we had right, but it was a little too wide from about the 10th fret up for him to get his thumb comfortably around the 5th string, so we just changed that dimension by a very little bit, maybe a 16th of an inch. And he wanted a satin finish, which we gave him. He wanted all mahogany, which we did. And he wanted a very high bridge, 7/8 of an inch.
I was going to ask you about the bridge next, yeah, which is also arched because it matches the radius of the fret.
Right. So, and then all that needs to be said is this, Steve, that we went over every component on the banjo and settled for nothing but the top of the line, the best possible components, price being no object. We did not want to put, this was not to be a popularly priced quote unquote instrument. It was to be affordable for anybody, but we needed to put the money into it to make it worthy of Bela's putting his name on it. It had to play and sound the way he would use it on stage, which he's been doing all the past year and some months.
And he travels with it. Right?
Exactly. He travels with two of them.
The darker one for some tunes and the darker head one, I would call it.
Right, the one with the black suede head, and then he has a white suede head on the other one.
And they sound great. I've seen them. I've heard them. You've heard them up close. And it really is a great, I will tell for the listeners if we have a little bit of time, that for me to get used to that arch and that raise, because I've never played them before, but once you get used to it and you find that right spot on the head, Bela plays closer to the neck than most.
Yeah, just to illustrate, here you go. I'm playing it an inch and a half from the bridge. Now, okay. Bela tone is more, let's say, to the west, closer to the neck.
And I can hear that difference. You can hear it. I think the audience can hear it. And that's where I wound up finding the tone is closer to the neck, because I experimented for a while.
So we did a lot of talking about pricing. And as I said, Wayne wanted it to be affordable for anybody looking for a professional-grade banjo. And this was really, the OB3 was the first try by Goldtone to get a professional-grade bluegrass banjo out on the market for a very reasonable $1,700. Due to all the development time and tooling and other expenses that went into the Bela model, and the fact that we designed a custom fiberglass road case for it as well, which is included in the price. So that came out being street priced at $3,700. We also did some calculations to see what it would cost to get such a banjo out of an American manufacturer. And that figure was closer to $7,000 or $8,000. So, again, bang for the buck.
Bang for the buck. And you can't say more than the fact that Bela has been involved in the development of these features. And I know you and I have talked about this. I talk to Mark on a regular basis. Changes were little small changes he was making. He had constant input into what was happening, and probably still does have some for his own personal sake.
There was a period during the development stage where Bela would talk on the phone daily for weeks at a time.
Yeah.
So for an hour at a time.
So this, the banjo that you have in your hand right now, the Bela Fleck Bluegrass Heart Banjo, this is what he wanted. This is what he likes. This is what he plays when he travels, and he records with it, I think, sometimes. And just
he went to Great Britain not long ago.
Yeah, that's right.
With
yeah.
his wife and kids, mm-hmm. and did some playing over there. I think he did some radio or TV broadcasts. And the only banjo he took was one of his bluegrass hearts.
Yeah. I don't know what more you can say than the fact that you worked with him, and Bela has said, yes, this is the banjo that you can put my name on.
Exactly. And his name is on it, two frets up from the end of the neck.
That's right. That's right. There's a heart at the top. It is the bluegrass heart banjo. Comes
in. Let's just say that the finish was not the only cosmetic thing that he wanted special. He also wanted Gibson-like inlays, but some of his own design as well.
Yeah.
And among those was a red heart on the peg head and in the 12th fret inlay between two leaves.
We do have marks from time. If you kind of moved your hand up to the peg head, what's this deal after the nut for the gold tone? Explain that a little bit. Zero glide.
Zero glide was an idea that Wayne came up with some years back to give some very, very tangible benefits by installing one. And one of them is that the open string tone would be the same as the fretted tone.
Yeah.
Because the zero glide part of it, it's a two-piece nut. There's a bone piece which goes right in place of the standard nut in the standard groove. But that is machined into a shape that will accept a piece of fret wire, which is a special fret wire that they have made for this, without the serrations on the tang of the fret, these little teeth. So it's a plain tang, and then can actually replace that fret as it wears. With a standard bone nut, as it wears, as the strings dig further into the bone nut, you have to replace the nut or shim it up. With this, you can actually change the fret.
And I knew that was a feature on the banjos and something that Wayne came up with, but I wanted you to mention that as part of this Bela banjo also.
The Bela banjo also has, we have a menu of options that you can see on the website that you can order from the factory, including the type of bridge you want, the type of tailpiece you want. There's the standard Bela setup, which is great. Some people might like a slightly different sound. Bela sound is very dark. The banjo can be set up to have more punch and ring in the higher frequencies, but any good setup person can get a huge variety of tones out of this banjo.
Even the armrest was for Bela's satisfaction.
Yeah, in fact, Wayne liked the Little Mountain armrest so much that he bought it. He bought the company.
Okay.
And we made some design changes. We changed the armrest itself is broader and more rounded, so it's much more comfortable in the previous design. And we also made an improvement to the way the mounting brackets that screw onto the banjo hooks are made. They used to be soldered together in two pieces, and I insisted that they be machined from one piece because those solder joints would break.
I think we're going to do a part two of this, Mark. We may do a second show, so we'll keep track of what you're talking about if we run out of time here.
I learned so much on this show. I hope that you do. That was my good friend, Mark Horowitz, who happens to be one of the most respected banjo teachers and developers, as you heard. I do think we're going to do a second show. We're going to kind of pare down some of the issues that we couldn't hit on that one, and we'll come back and talk to Mark about this Bela Fleck Bluegrass Heart Banjo and other things too, because Mark knows just about everything, as he will tell you, as I will tell you. He's become a very good friend of mine. So I hope you learned something there. You can go back on the archive, by the way, at Unreal Bluegrass, and you can hear Jeff Stelling talk about how and why he came up with the Stelling. You can listen to Jamie Deering talk about Deering banjos. You can listen to Tom Neckville. A couple times Tom is on there talking about the very special qualities of the Neckville banjos. You can listen to Sonny Osborne. We talked many times about the Osborne Chief. And you can even listen to Dana Bourgeois talk about his guitars. As I recall, Dana did that interview. He was in a car parked in hurricane weather. I think that's what it was. And I asked him to go ahead and forget it and do it another time, and he felt comfortable doing it there. But I love talking to luthiers. I love talking about instruments because I get to learn so much. Thank you so much, Mark, for participating. There will be more later. Thank you, folks, for tuning in to Unreal Bluegrass. I hope you've learned something about banjos in general, and specifically the Bluegrass Heart banjo with Bela Fleck's name on it from Gold Tone.